Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Jewish man who saved a Ku Klux Klansman from being torn apart by an angry mob at a Klan rally in Anaheim, California on Saturday. Brian Levin, a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, who previously served as associate director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force, joins us to describe what took place at a Klan rally where he saved the life of the Grand Dragon of the Loyal White Knights of California from angry protesters who attacked a group of Klansmen who had defended themselves with knives and the sharpened tip of a Confederate flagpole, stabbing some of the protesters before being overwhelmed. Then we'll speak with Josh Putnam, professor of political science at the University of Georgia, who writes the blog Frontloading HQ, which specializes in the delegate allocation process. He joins us to discuss tomorrow's Super Tuesday races and the delegate counts up for grabs as the competition on the Republican side enters a critical stage for Trump's challengers Cruz and Rubio, who are lagging in the delegate count, which on March the 15th switches to a winner-take-all mode, making it more likely Trump will then become unbeatable. Then finally, we'll look into the election results in Iran with Abbas Milani, the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University, who previously taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, and is the author of the new book, Politics and Culture in Contemporary Iran, Challenging the Status Quo. We'll discuss the surprising gains by the pro-reform candidates who, in spite of vetting by the hardliners who purged liberal candidates, not only have a substantial block of seats in the parliament, but the moderates also won a 59% majority in the Assembly of Experts who will choose a successor to the Supreme Leader. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes and terrorism. Previously, he served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City police officer in Harlem and Washington Heights during the crack wars of the 1980s, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Ian, as always, thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad you're in one piece because, Brian, you were something of a hero in a paradoxical way. You saved the life of a Klansman on Saturday in Anaheim, where a Ku Klux Klan rally erupted in violence. So walk us through the incident here from your point of view, since you were very central to saving the life of one of the Klansmen who was assaulted by protesters. And it does seem that most of the violence, actually, in terms of stabbing, came from the Klansmen themselves who stabbed protesters. But let's focus in on the particular Klansman whose life you saved, the fellow that was wearing a shirt that said he was a Grand Dragon. So I take it, in terms of Klansman parlance, he was one of the leaders of this KKK rally.
Well, if he's going to call himself Grand Dragon, I'll at least just settle for the title of Mensch. But but anyway, look, here's the thing. The Klansmen have all been released. There were basically initial confrontations that took place on two sides, the passenger side and the driver's side of the Klan's vehicle as it was trying to park and the folks were trying to get out their signage and material. I saw part of what was going on with the passenger side, but I was on the driver's side, so I really saw action there more out of my periphery. And I cannot say on that side, and that was the side that the Klansman who was accused of doing some stabbing was first getting into conflict. So I do not know who struck who or who stabbed who first on that side, because my view was partially obstructed by the vehicle. I could see things going over the top. I could see things in the back. And then as the vehicle struck, it looked like just one of those old Looney Tune cartoons of just like dust and hands and feet and all kinds of things. But remember, a lot of people were wearing black. including the Klansmen. They were not in robes. They were dressed in black pants and button-down black shirts with Klan insignias on it and the Confederate flag. So I can tell you that certainly there was physical violence on both sides of the vehicle. On my side, which was I was coming forward to the driver's side, I could see Klansmen under attack. So I don't know who did what on the passenger side. As the vehicle was exiting quite quickly, when they decided not to park, the vehicle was struck by wooden planks that smashed out the rear passenger window and smashed the windshield. This left three Klansmen, one of whom was the one who was involved with the stabbing, which I heard him later say he said was in self-defense. But I did not see what was going on there in a clear manner. My gaze was focused not to my right at this point, but forward as two Klansmen were moving forward, one of which was the Grand Dragon, Mr. Quigg, who was either pushed to the ground or fell to the ground, and at that point was set upon by a crowd, a small crowd, including a football player-sized fellow who's now wanted by the police, who started vigorously kicking him to the abdomen and head. I immediately ran up there while filming, outstretched my arm, and put myself over him as he was crouched.
This is over Quigg, the Grand Dragon.
That is correct. Who, by the way, is a loathsome character who went to South Carolina to celebrate the Charleston shooter. Okay? This is the kind of just reprehensible person we're talking about.
So he's abandoned by his fellow Klansmen in the big SUV. They drive off. They abandon him, and you rescue him as he is set upon by protesters who are kicking the hell out of him.
I tried to accomplish a couple of things. I'm former NYPD. One of the things that I wanted to do was to give space, a physical buffer, so that he could get up. What I didn't want to have is an immobilized, stationary figure on the ground who is a target for a growing crowd's aggression. So the goal was to give him space and some time so that he could be helped up. And I think there was a Klansman who helped him up. So he got up. But at that point, we continued to be set upon, including with an individual who I believe had a wooden plank, and then another one who had a metal rod, which I later figured was the flagpole that was used on one of two flags that the Klan brought with them, one of which was an American flag, the other was a Confederate flag. They continued to surround us, to lunge at us, and I, while filming with one hand, outstretched my arm as we're moving forward and said, "Do not hit this man! Do not hit this man!" And then I counseled the Klansmen, you know, "Hey, it's time to go." And this was all captured on my video.
But where were the Anaheim police?
I don't know.
I mean, this was an announced rally. This was they announced that they were rallying against immigrants and Muslims. That was their flyer that they put out. It wasn't exactly a mystery, right? That's why the protesters showed up.
So, well, there was a mystery in this regard, and that is nobody knew what the expected time or actual place where the Klansmen were going to be. When I say the park is a decent-sized park, we didn't know whether the Klan was going to come from 10 to 10:30 or 1 to 1:30. So, you know, I was expecting them to come almost an hour later because they didn't come between 10 and 10:30. I do not believe, and you know, you'll have to check with the authorities, I don't believe the Klan properly coordinated with the police. They did not get a permit. If there's a permit, at least that sets a time and an exact location. So, you know, I don't know if the police were made aware of exactly when the Klan was going to be there and whether the Klan even wanted to notify the police of the exact time and location when they would come. Because we even had news vans that were leaving because we didn't know whether the Klan was going to show up at all. And I think that was part of the issue, that the Klan was not forthcoming with regard to what time they were going to arrive.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He was formerly associate director of legal affairs for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was a New York City policeman in Harlem and Washington Heights during the crack wars in the 1980s, and recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. And the fellow, though, that you protected from the mob, this fellow, William Quigg, who's apparently a resident of Anaheim, is also the leader of the Loyal White Knights in California. And they apparently describe themselves as the Klan without robes and model themselves on David Duke, the former Klan leader that Donald Trump failed to recognize his name and disassociate himself from.
Yes, although when I asked him about David Duke, he said he doesn't have any direct connection with him. He's a separate organization. But what I think was interesting is they did not show up in robes. They showed up in long black khaki-type pants, but black in color, and black shirts that had Klan and Confederate and other insignias on it.
But the point that the video that's gone viral, which is, I guess, the video that you had, you know, you're protecting this guy from the protesters, and then eventually the police seem to arrive, and he's sitting on the curb, this Quigg fellow. He's bleeding, and there's an Anaheim policeman guarding him. And you walk up to him and say to him, well, you tell me what you said to him.
How do you feel that a Jewish guy possibly saved your life today?
To which he replied,
I thank you. Thank you.
But
he also said that he would have saved a colored person. His words, not mine.
Well, now, were there any colored persons, to use his parlance, among those that attacked these Klansmen?
Yes. There were different segments of the crowd. Some people were off to the side looking at what was going on. There was one person who was in this area who I think tried to kind of hold people back, but not as aggressively as me. In other words, just kind of more gently. And then there was one other person who, halfway through, when the Klansman was knocked to the ground and struck again, said something. And I said to the protesters, this is not what Dr. King would have wanted. Everybody step back. Do not hit this man. Do not hit this man, in that tone of voice. All the time while trying to film and keep them away. Sometimes they got ahead of me, but I generally tried to keep a pace and interpose myself between the Klansmen and some of the counter demonstrators. Remember too, not all the counter protesters were violent, but there were enough that were.
And I've seen the video, and indeed, when you say to him that, how do you feel about the Jewish person saving your life, he says thank you. I mean, he's clearly rattled and quite grateful. So, well, I guess the question arises, Brian Levin, clearly you weren't a protester, but you were there. So why were you there?
I was there because from time to time, and not that regularly anymore, because I've been outed by these hate groups, so it's difficult for me to go and kind of collect information anonymously. But I like to get their literature, count how many members show up, what topics are they talking about, what is on their literature, what are some of their planned activities for the future, what do they think are trends that are going on and the issues that are going on that they're going to exploit and capitalize upon. So this kind of research is not unusual, but for someone like me, because I used to work at Southern Poverty Law Center, for instance, way back when, over 20 years ago, it's difficult for me to kind of ensconce myself in these groups when they're not in public like some other researchers. So these are opportunities that come up from time to time where I can actually interview these individuals.
Well, apparently the police did show up because six Klan members, five men and a woman, were arrested along with seven protesters, six men and one woman. And you say the big guy that was kicking the Klansman, whose life you saved, he disappeared, right? They're looking for him.
He's wanted by the police now. All the Klansmen, though, were released because of what the police have concluded was their actions, according to them, were in self-defense.
But they used knives, and they used the sharpened tip of their flagpoles holding up the Confederate flag. So their weapons, knives, are unequivocal weapon, aren't they?
Well, here's the thing. That portion of the attack that took place, or that conflict that took place, was on the passenger side, and I'm approaching from the driver's side. And it happened so quickly that what I can tell you is, from my vantage point, I couldn't make out who was who because of the, I was coming, not from a great distance, but there was also Klansmen being attacked on the driver's side, so that took most of my attention. And when I came up there, and it was pretty much contemporaneous with the start of this, they were under attack. At least on the driver's side. I cannot speak other than what I saw afterwards in photographs and video, which was hard to make out. But I did not see that initial portion with the kind of depth that I could draw a conclusion as to who was doing what. In other words, I saw fists flying and sticks and people, and they were clad in black, but both sides were clad in black.
I see.
It was and immediately as the vehicle was leaving, my gaze then turned to the vehicle leaving, and these two Klansmen, one of whom was an older gentleman with a silver hair and a beard, along with Mr. Quigg, who were being attacked. During the time that I was around them, they did nothing but try to avoid getting severely beaten.
Well, just in closing, Brian Levin, in the last minute, how do you feel about saving Klansmen?
I'd do it again in a second.
But you've been criticized, haven't you?
Yes.
And what do you tell your critics?
Nothing.
I see. Well, Brian, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. They got a little bit of a Judaic education as to what my faith says I should do.
Well, I hope it works on them. I wouldn't hold my breath, but I hope it works on them.
Well, thank you so much. But I'll tell you, it was some intervention from somewhere that I was jostled but uninjured. Thank God that the Anaheim police came, because whatever you want to say about their response time, within that 3 minutes when they arrived, it was instantaneous that they controlled that scene and they saved people's lives, probably mine as well.
Well, again, I thank you, Brian Levin, again, the criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes and terrorism. He previously served as associate director of the legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center, Klan's Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City policeman in Harlem and Washington Heights during the crack wars of the 1980s, and recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on counterterrorism and intelligence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a specialist on the delegate count, which reaches a critical stage tomorrow, after which on March the 15th, Trump's lead may become unbeatable.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Josh Putnam, who's a professor of political science at the University of Georgia and the author of the blog Front Loading HQ, which covers the delegate allocation process. And of course, in this key vote tomorrow, Josh, on Super Tuesday, I believe the Republicans have 595 and the Democrats have 1,004 delegates at stake. Why the difference?
Well, the difference is based on how each party apportions delegates to each of the states. The Democrats start off with a heck of a lot more delegates than the Republicans do in the first place. Generally, the DNC has about twice as many delegates as the Republican Party. So we see that borne out in days like Super Tuesday when both parties have a similar number of contests. So, I mean, it's roughly about twice as many delegates as the Democrats have at stake tomorrow.
And there are, the Republicans are also in, what, one or two more states? I think they're in Wyoming, aren't they, and the Democrats aren't?
The Republicans have a series of contests in states tomorrow that won't have preference votes. They're kind of opening the process of selecting delegates, but they won't actually allocate them until state conventions later in the process. So Democrats end up with about 13 contests tomorrow. The Republicans will have 11.
So in terms then of the preponderance of the states, they're mostly in the South, aren't they? That was the very purpose of having Super Tuesday, wasn't it, to sort of counterbalance or as a counterweight against the earlier primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire?
Sure. From a historical perspective, Democrats who were still in control of Southern state legislatures back in the early to mid-1980s hatched a plan to move all of the southern states, the states of the former Confederacy, to an early spot in the calendar. They had seen in previous cycles that the process had produced more liberal northeastern nominees, and southern moderate to conservative Democrats wanted to have a more moderate nominee. Who would theoretically do better against a Republican in the general election. So they were able to coordinate this back to the 1988 cycle. The only problem was that it backfired, that instead of the entire region kind of speaking with one voice behind one candidate, they split their vote. So, Texas and Florida, the big states in the South on the day, go to Michael Dukakis. Jesse Jackson does well in the Deep South. And Al Gore does well in what's often referred to as the peripheral South. And so states across the South kind of scattered across the calendar thereafter, and we've seen for this 2016 cycle a resurgence of this Southern Super Tuesday idea on a much smaller scale than was the case in 1988. But, the Republican Secretary of State here in Georgia kind of spearheaded the effort, and we've got six, seven states from the South or border regions that'll be holding contests tomorrow.
So since the Democrats don't usually get too many votes in the South, it's a bit ironic, isn't it, that Hillary Clinton is going to probably get all these victories in the South but won't carry them, assuming she's a nominee in the general?
That's generally been the trend, is that Republicans have locked down much of the South, with the exception of, say, North Carolina and Virginia and Florida in the last couple of cycles. But what the South does offer is a high proportion of African Americans that are a significant block within the Democratic primary electorate. So it carries a lot of weight here early in the process on the Democratic side.
And with Alabama, Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, and Virginia voting tomorrow, there, and of course the Republicans, have, as we mentioned, already have contests in Alaska and Wyoming. The Democrats will caucus in American Samoa. You're in Georgia, Josh Putnam, and again, Josh Putnam is a political scientist at the University of Georgia. His blog, Frontloading HQ, studies the delegate allocation process in primary elections, and I take it that in Georgia, Trump is fairly substantially ahead, is he not?
Given the small amount of polling we've got here, he's seemingly well positioned to do well not only in Georgia but across the South tomorrow, yeah.
And the key will be, of course, at least for Ted Cruz, will be Texas. So far, the polls, as far as I know, indicate that Cruz can hold on to Texas, but do you think there could be a surprise?
We've gotten a kind of a mixed picture from the polls in Texas. It's either very close between Cruz and Trump, or Cruz has a modest lead there. I think the big thing is that's kind of a win for Trump, in that Cruz doing well in Texas is going to keep delegates based on the rules in Texas away from Rubio. And if Rubio is second across much of the rest of the country tomorrow in the contests that are being held, then they're going to end up in a similar position in the delegate count come Wednesday, and Trump's going to be significantly advantaged.
And given that Texas is not a winner-take-all, I guess the winner-take-all states tend to come on March the 15th, do they not?
Well, the proportionality window, as it's called, closes on March 14th, and then states after that point on the calendar have the option of being winner-take-all, but they can choose whichever method they want to. So we've only got 9 truly winner-take-all states on the calendar this year, and they kick in on March 15th in a couple of weeks. Florida and Ohio are the two kind of big delegate prizes that are winner-take-all, and they're right there on March 15th.
So, Josh Putnam, since your blog, Frontloading HQ, studies the delegate allocation process, you're the perfect person to ask, even though I'm not asking you to be a clairvoyant here, but what's your sense of what's going to happen tomorrow? The indications amongst the punditry are that this is a sort of make-or-break moment, whether it's going to be Trump all the way or whether the challengers, either Cruz or Rubio or, in effect, both, who allegedly represent the last gasps of the Republican establishment trying to stop what many see as a catastrophe for the party. Do you see it in those kind of apocalyptic terms?
Well, again, that's apocalypse, I guess, is in this case in the eye of the beholder. But tomorrow in on both the Republican and Democratic sides, the story is going to be about how much of a delegate advantage that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are likely to build tomorrow. No one's going to wrap it up. But someone, and those two are probably likely to really begin to pad their already modest delegate advantages. And if they're able to push it high enough, it's going to make it really difficult for their opponents to catch back up. At least on the Republican side, there's kind of a silver lining that Florida and Ohio are out there as winner-take-all states in a couple of weeks. But Trump is in the lead in those states, and if one person, not Trump, doesn't sweep those states, it becomes very much more difficult for someone to catch up with Trump if he's able to build a delegate lead in the 200 to 250 delegate range tomorrow.
Well, it's my understanding that Trump is, again, substantially ahead in the polls in Florida, even though it's Marco Rubio's state.
Correct.
But in Ohio, the expectation, I believe, is that Governor Kasich should be able to win there. So what's your latest on that?
The latest poll that I saw on this was late last week, and Trump was ahead there. Kasich was in second and maybe about 4 or 5 points behind, but trailing.
I see. But that's supposedly the rationale why he's staying in, isn't it? That
It certainly is. His campaign is hedged its bets on both kind of Michigan on March 8th and Ohio on March 15th. But it's a very narrow path to the nomination for him, and his best case scenario is a contested convention at the end of the process.
But there's apparently been pressure on Kasich to drop out. I believe that Mitt Romney's called him because he feels that he's taking votes away from Rubio. And on the other side, it's pretty clear that Dr. Carson is taking votes away from Cruz. I'm not sure whether there's any pressure on Carson to drop out, but you have to question why he's still in the race. So if these two do drop out, what's your sense of whether that will make a difference? Will it be too little, too late?
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with a very small window of time now in which consolidation has to happen, and has to happen quickly for a not Trump in this race on the Republican side. Every little bit would help towards that. So yeah, I think you're right in assessing that Carson is peeling off votes, most likely from Cruz or maybe even Trump. And that John Kasich is only hurting Marco Rubio's chances of consolidating the establishment part of the Republican Party.
But is tomorrow too late? I mean, if I guess after the 15th, it's more likely to be too late, right?
Right, right. I mean, these next 2 weeks are really critical to that. And as I said, the clock's ticking on that. It's going to be very difficult for that sort of consolidation to happen. It just doesn't come that quickly in this process or quickly enough. And I don't know that I see it happening in a two-week time span.
So in terms of then the work that you do in studying the allocation of delegates, what's your sense, Josh Putnam, of the likelihood then of where we're going to be when particularly the Republican, I don't think there's a lot of mystery about the Democratic side, although there could be some surprises tomorrow. But I guess it's pretty clear that Hillary Clinton's going to clean up with most of the states. And do you think that Bernie Sanders is going to pick up a few in the north? I suppose there's a possibility with Massachusetts and Minnesota.
Certainly
Vermont, right?
One would imagine, yeah. I mean, there may be some wins out there for Sanders, but as I said, Clinton's position to do really well tomorrow, build a delegate lead that based on the proportional rules the Democratic Party uses, it's going to make it hard for, number one, her to pull away, but number two, for Bernie Sanders to catch up to her, even if it's a modest delegate advantage around 100 delegates.
So she's likely to go into the convention then with it pretty much locked up, which would make the convention itself not much of an event, or at least it wouldn't be any...
Well, it would make it normal.
Well, isn't that one of the peculiarities of this race, though, that the normal is on the Democratic side and the... trying to think of another word, a word other than abnormal on the Republican.
Atypical, let's say.
Yeah, let's say atypical on the Republican side. That is supposedly contributing to what's called the enthusiasm factor, that there's actually, maybe it's because there's a lot more coverage and the press are more interested in Trump than they are in the Democrats. But do you see an enthusiasm factor there, that if the normal is not exciting and the non-traditional is that an advantage, you think, to the Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is the enthusiasm is making its way into the turnout numbers, that the Democrats are off from what were very, very high water marks for turnout in 2008, and the Republicans are setting records on their side. And a lot of that has to do with Trump bringing voters in. The downside to that enthusiasm is that if we're particularly heading into a contested convention, then you're dealing with the party kind of being split apart potentially and becoming divisive, and that has the potential to make the Republican Party's job harder in the fall. They've got to work harder to bring people home to vote potentially for Trump.
Well, then, just in closing, what's your sense of we've covered the Democratic side and predicting where they're going to be by the convention, with perhaps Hillary having a lock on it and the convention being less than a cliffhanger itself. On the Republican side, that's clearly where a lot of people are talking about a brokered convention. That's getting less likely, isn't it? Well, I guess we'll know
Well, yeah. I mean, we always have this discussion about the possibility of a contested convention every 4 years. The difference this time is that we've got a front runner that the party network, not just the Republican National Committee, but Republicans in general, aren't necessarily enthusiastic about. So there's an effort among maybe a majority of Republican supporters out there to try and put this down, that their only play in the end may be a contested convention, keeping Trump below the requisite number of delegates to clinch the nomination before the convention. And that's the real difference. But these next 2 weeks are going to be really instrumental in laying that out. If Trump is able to do well tomorrow, and by all appearances he's well positioned to do that, to build a delegate lead, and additionally do well in Florida and Ohio in a couple of weeks, then that's really instructive about where this race is, where it's going, and that it's likely to end in a conclusive result of Donald Trump being the presumptive nominee heading into the convention.
And if that you know, causes a fissure in the Republican Party, as some suggest, because there's certainly, at this point, there's quite a bit of resistance to Trump. And there's some people saying, you know, that they might even vote for Hillary on the Republican side if Trump's a nominee. I don't know what figures they represent, but
right.
But assuming that this kind of concern grows with as Trump's lead grows, do you see any possibility of a third party or an alternative choice like a Romney or the former mayor of New York, Bloomberg?
Not necessarily from that angle. I mean, possibly that's out there. I mean, I think we're hearing whispers of folks within the Republican Party. Again, the network, not the formal Republican National Committee, talking about such an eventuality if Trump becomes the nominee. But again, that's something that's very difficult to coordinate and get a candidate on the ballot in all the states in the fall. And there would be some motivation to coalesce behind even Trump in that instance. Because, again, counter to what you mentioned before, I'm not hearing a lot about Republicans voting for Hillary Clinton, that they would choose an alternative of staying home rather than vote for Trump or Clinton.
Well, Josh Putnam, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure thing. Fun to chat, Ian. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Josh Putnam, who is a professor of political science at the University of Georgia. His blog, Frontloading HQ, specializes in the delicate allocation process. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the surprising gains by the moderates in the Iranian elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project, and until 1986, taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center for International Relations. He's the author of The Shah, and his new book just out is Politics and Culture in Contemporary Iran, Challenging the Status Quo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
And do you think these elections that have just taken place, even though they were heavily vetted by the hardliners who control Iran's political process, it looks, at least in terms of what happened in Tehran and in the urban centers, that the vetting process on the part of the hardliners, wasn't exactly foolproof.
Yes, I think what happened was that the cleverness of the electorate, and I don't think it's just Iran. In Tehran, Tehran is the most obvious example of the defeat of the status quo. But throughout Iran, I think people cleverly found a way of turning, as you absolutely accurately say, one of the most vetted, one of the most engineered effort at an election into a virtual referendum and saying no to the conservative wing that has dominated politics for many years.
And, of course, the conservative hardliners have had the best of both worlds in terms of having the outward appearance of democratic choice, but basically guaranteeing the results that they want. Do you think that that paradigm has broken down for them?
I think it has. And if this is, again, the most recent example. If you look back over the last few elections, at virtually every election, they have had this problem where they try to control this process they try to pre-select possible acceptable candidates, and somehow people, often out of desperation, find a way of sending a clear message that we don't like what you're doing, we don't like your policy, we don't like your vetting process, we don't like your vetters. These, I mean, two of the people who were rejected from the Council of Experts are the master engineers of the past vetting process. They're the most conservative senior ideologues of the regime, and they have received a resounding no. Khamenei's son's father-in-law couldn't be elected to the parliament in Tehran, and he was clearly preparing himself to be the next speaker of the parliament. He can't even get into the parliament. That, to me, indicates that there is, as Hamlet would say, something rotten in the state of Tehran.
Well, of course, we all noticed the irony that the vetting process disqualified the grandson of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Absolutely. They disqualified him. They disqualified more than 90% of anyone who had any semblance of being anything other than the conservatives. Nevertheless, virtually everyone who was allowed to run as a reformist has won. The top candidate in Tehran in the parliamentary election is the head of the reformist wing of the Iranian politics. He has won by enormous margin compared to the next person. So everything has turned into something that bespeaks of a discord between a conservative, well-muscled, well-oiled machine that controls part of the IRGC, has a lot of money at its disposal, controls the vetting process, and the great majority of the Iranian people who say, enough is enough, give us some breathing room.
So can you give us a count then of you know, reformers versus hardliners in the new makeup of the parliament?
Well, I think that there are essentially three groups in the parliament, those who were running on a reformist platform, those who were running on what they call a principalist platform, they were the conservatives, and those who were running as independent, essentially. Clearly, the combination of the reformists and the independents will have the majority in the parliament. But many of these elections for the parliament are now to be determined in the second round. No one had a clear majority in the first round, and there is a second round of voting to be determined. And I think that needs, for final numbers, we need to wait for those. But Tehran is a very critical part of the country. It is the economic hub. It is the cultural hub. It is the political hub. It's where about maybe a quarter of the population, a fifth of the population lives. Iran has about 75. Tehran has about 14 million population. And to be so clearly routed in Tehran, both in the parliamentary election, where they couldn't get a single candidate in, and in the election to the Assembly of Experts, I think will have some serious consequence in the political domain. But how much it will have, I think, remains to be seen.
Well, of course, the list of the constituency that ran in Tehran, the reformist, the 30 candidates standing on this list known as the List of Hope. And, of course, eight women were elected in that list to the reformist-backed List of Hope. That's a pretty poetic way to describe a candidate slate, isn't it? The List of Hope.
Absolutely. I mean, that candidate of hope is the combination of the reformist and the government. And the fact that they did have eight women, I think, is a remarkable accomplishment. The Iranian political structure is, again, sadly incongruent with the fabric of Iranian society. 60-odd% of Iranian college graduates are women, and there's virtually a complete absence of women in the leadership of the country. Certainly in the top leadership, there is a complete absence. And now women are pushing. There was a campaign to increase the number of women present in the parliament, and the numbers are a little better than they were before, but still far from what they need to be.
And so given this that the moderates won 59% majority in the Assembly of Experts. That's a pretty significant thing as well, isn't it? That's the 88-member body which will choose a successor to the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who I believe has prostate cancer and may not be around for much longer. So wouldn't that in a way be a more – isn't that in a way a more significant victory?
Absolutely. I think that's very critical. And the fact that by far the person that got the most vote in that election was Rafsanjani, and he had been the subject of a lot of vitriol from the conservatives, who accused him of being an agent of the British, of being a co-conspirator with the BBC and with Western media and with the Los Angeles Iranian diaspora channels in trying to undermine the conservatives. And he had said before the election that if I'm elected to this, I'm going to make sure that this council does its constitutional job. The council's constitutional mandate is to oversee the work of the leader. Now, the two of the three leaders of the conservatives who have been now outvoted have been the chief theorists of the theory that this council has no role in oversight of the leader. The leader is chosen by God, and our job is to essentially go and find out what God's wishes and discover the new leader. So you now have Rafsanjani, who says, no, we've got to go back to the Constitution and have oversight over this guy. And the a great sway, I think, in who will be the next leader once Mr. Khamenei meets his maker.
Well, this is bad news for Khamenei's son, Mujtaba, isn't it? He's a hardliner. He's the guy largely responsible for Ahmadinejad being chosen as president, I understand. His family, of course, have an enormous amount of money that they've accrued. And there are some rumors that he wanted to succeed his father. I would assume that these election results are a blow to his ambitions.
I think so. I think very much a blow to his ambition, to his family's ambition. Mr. Haddad Adel was clearly the Khamenei candidate for the next Speaker of the House. He's now not even elected to the third. He couldn't make it out of a group of 30. So they have been dealt a very, very embarrassing blow. And I think Mujtaba recognizes that the only way that he will ever have a remote chance of having a role after his father is if the IRGC organizes some kind of a military takeover of the government. And I don't see that happening, because I think the IRGC is not of the same opinion. The IRGC is clearly of not one view. The head of the Quds Brigade, for example, the most radical arm of the IRGC, actually supported a candidate who was being the conservatives were trying to get him unelected because they thought he had sided with the reformists, that is the current Speaker of the House. He had gone on their blacklist, but the commander of the Quds Brigade met with him. So to me, Mujtaba's chances of having a role will only be with, in the unlikely case that the IRGC decides that they have to step in and take over.
But it sounds like there's, as you just told us, that there's a split, a fissure in the IRGC.
Clearly, I think there is. I think there is a fissure in the IRGC, not just in terms of this election. I think many people forget that many of the people who are now in the Rouhani government and have sided with the reformists are past commanders of the IRGC, are some of the top past commanders of the IRGC, some of the people in the ministry, some of the people who are running very important government offices, advisors to Rouhani. So the notion that the IRGC is only the conservatives who are kowtowing to Khamenei, I think, is a misconception.
So what would the split be then? I mean, you know, this has been one of the great ironies of Iran, is that the IRGC and the Basijah militia, the Pashtun, are essentially the guns and the thugs of the regime, and then they crack down, as we recall, and they, you know, they broke the Green Movement that sprung out of the Arab Spring quite brutally. And at the end of the day, you know, that's, you have to recognize that for all of the aspirations of democracy, and as the Nobel laureate Shireen Ebadi says, you know, the embers burn under the ashes. Nevertheless, this has been the reality. So do you think that there's a possibility that the split in the IRGC is to do with, I mean, well, let me ask you this. What is the nature of the split between the IRGC, these factions in the IRGC? Is one trying to sort of adhere to the sort of revolutionary principles, and the other to the perks and privileges that they've managed to enrich themselves with?
Yes. I mean, I think that there's at least three kinds of splits. One is that I think IRGC is not just thugs and thieves. It's thugs, thieves, and carpetbaggers, the new rich, the new, remarkably new rich class that have been the IRGC commanders and are now cashing in on these no-bid contracts and all the corruption that Iran is now infamous for. And there is, I think, a other minority, but I think powerful minority, people who have seen the writing on the wall, people who know that the status quo is untenable, people who know that the conservatives don't have a solution to Iran's problems. I think Shireen Ebadi is right. I wrote an article in the Atlantic called Iran's Incremental Revolution long before this election, where my argument was that if you look at Iranian society below this dour surface of angry septuagenarian clerics, there is a vibrant society that is thriving and is trying to change this regime without having a regime change. In other words, without going through the process of a Syrian civil war, a Libyan civil war, an Iraqi fiasco, but nevertheless, trying to find a way of chipping away at the power of this disproportionately powerful, unelected, corrupt, incompetent leadership. It takes a while. It takes patience. But I think they're doing it gingerly. And this election is one more baby step in that direction.
But the rural-urban split, which appears to be evident in these results, is that, could you make a comparison to say, American politics, where you have largely the blue voters are in urban areas and the red voters are in the rural areas, and that the rural areas of the red states in the United States, particularly in the South, as you know, the Christian right, the Christian coalition, or the evangelicals have a lot of sway. So is there a similarity in Iran?
Well, first of all, the current state of American politics, you can't compare to anything. This has become, I mean, when they're talking about people's wet pants and other stuff, I don't know what country's politics can compare to this level of discourse. But I think, that we still have to look at some of the data that will come out of this election. But if people have looked at the data from the last election and the Rouhani election, and the notion that the conservatives had a lock on the villages and small towns, and that the urban middle class is the only base for the reformers, which is part of the narrative that the conservatives have been in the last 2 days trying to articulate, that doesn't hold to scrutiny. When people actually went and looked at the numbers, Rouhani won in many, many, many of the small towns in the countryside. I think the level of disgruntlement with the status quo is much more pervasive. They basically have between 5 to 8 million of the vote, and the other side has about 20 to 25, 27 million of the votes. And this 7 million has been consistent in the last 2-3 elections. They can't get more than that. And this is after having a remarkable access to the media is controlled by the conservatives, the access to money. Khamenei and the IRGC have access to almost endless supply that they can pump into these elections. Nevertheless, the other side, handicapped, keeps beating them. So the notion that the conservatives are the darling of the countryside and only the westernized moderates, westernized middle class in Tehran are the advocates of the reformists, I think doesn't hold to scrutiny. But whether in this election will hold or not, we have to wait till we get the data, actually.
Well, just in closing then, Abbas Milani, when do you see these election results translating into all of the aspirations that have been expressed that go along with the nuclear deal, support for the nuclear deal, with the expectation amongst the young, the women, and the business people in Iran that the nuclear deal is the sort of opening wedge, the precursor, if you will, for reintegration into the global community and therefore access to investment and change and all of the things that the people clearly hope for? The impression I get is that they're sick to death. I mean, I can't imagine living under a theocratic government. If the idea of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson being the head of state is a complete nightmare. So they've been under this nightmare for, 40-plus years?
Yeah, 40 years, almost 40 years, yes. You know, I'm reminded of an episode of Seinfeld where they talk about how ending a relationship is like trying to tip over a heavy refrigerator. You push it and it moves, you push it and it moves. And after several push and pull, finally it tips over. This is one more push that people are giving to this rather heavy and soul-drenching regime that has and truly, as I think you accurately described, tried to make society bereft of all energy, all creativity, all woman's presence, all youthful presence, all music. But society underneath there is doing its work, and it, I think, has decided that it's going to pay the price of a little bit longer endurance of this nightmare rather than trying to change overnight with a process that is unknown in terms of how much destruction it might bring to Iran.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Abbas Milani.
It's a pleasure talking with you, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Abbas Milani, who's a director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding directors of the Iran Democracy Project and, until 1986, taught in Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the board of directors of the university's Center for International Relations. He's the author of The Shah, and his latest book just out is Politics and Culture in Contemporary Iran, Challenging the Status Quo. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.